Okay, so you know how sometimes when you're going through contracts and you're trying to figure out all those IP issues, it can really feel like you're walking through a legal maze.
Yeah, absolutely. I think every law student out there can relate to that feeling.
Oh, for sure. It's a challenge. And we're going to tackle one of those today head on by diving deep into a case that really throws light on this whole thing.
All right, sounds good.
It's called Fantastic Fakes v. Pickwick International.
Oh, yeah, this one's a classic. And it's still relevant even today because it really shows us the line between, just a company breaking a promise in a contract versus actually crossing over into actual copyright infringement.
Exactly. And it shows just how important it is to use the right words when you're putting together these legal agreements.
Couldn't agree more.
So the year is 1981, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is looking at this case that started with recordings. They're called sound-alike recordings.
Oh, I see.
Fantastic Fakes was the company making them. Basically, they were making recordings that sounded just like big hits.
So like cover bands, but for recordings.
Pretty much. And they gave Pickwick International, which was a distributor, a non-exclusive license for 2 years to actually sell these recordings.
Okay, makes sense.
Now we've got our materials right here. We've got some pointers for the podcast, a detailed analysis of the case, and then a standard case brief just to make sure that we're hitting all the important legal points.
Perfect.
And our whole mission today is to break this down for you, the listener, and so you can see why it's still such an important case.
I'm ready when you are.
All right, let's get started. So, first things first, we need to set the stage.
Right. Always a good starting point.
So, Fantastic Fakes, they owned the copyrights to all these sound recordings that they were making.
Okay.
Back in April 1976, they signed this licensing agreement with Pickwick. And this agreement gave Pickwick the okay to distribute these recordings, but only for a certain time.
Right.
But here's the catch. There was a really important condition attached to all of
Oh,
this.
there's always a catch. What was it?
Right? There always is. Section 2 of this agreement stated very clearly that Pickwick had to put a copyright notice on every single record that they sold.
I see.
And not just any copyright notice. This notice had to say that Fantastic Fakes owned the copyright.
So giving them credit, basically acknowledging that they were the ones behind it.
Exactly. It seems
Wow.
pretty straightforward, right?
Yeah, on the surface it does.
But here's where things get interesting.
Right.
Pickwick decided to go ahead and use copyright notices that said they owned the copyright.
Oh, so they were basically taking credit for Fantastic Fakes work.
Yeah, essentially.
Well, that's a bold
Oh,
move.
definitely. Fantastic Fakes was not happy about this.
Understandably so.
And they took Pickwick to court arguing two main things.
Okay, let's hear them.
First, they said Pickwick had infringed on their copyright by misusing their recording.
Okay, so that's the copyright infringement claim.
And second, they said Pickwick had just plain breached their contract by not sticking to what they had agreed to.
Right, breach of contract, like the classic legal combo.
Right.
So what happened next?
Well, the trial court made a decision that might surprise you.
Oh, lay it on me.
They actually sided with Pickwick.
Really?
Yeah, on the copyright infringement claim.
Yeah.
They did this through what's called a summary judgment.
Okay, so let's break that down for our listeners.
Yeah, summary judgment basically means the judge decided that based on the evidence they saw right off the bat, there wasn't even enough there for the copyright infringement claim to even go to a full trial.
So they dismissed it before it really got going.
Yeah.
Interesting, but how can you use the wrong copyright info and not be infringing? That's what I don't get.
That's a great question, and it goes right to the heart of the legal relationship created by that agreement between Fantastic Fakes and Pickwick.
I see.
When the Fifth Circuit looked at this case, they really zeroed in on this distinction between something called a covenant and something called a condition precedent in contract law.
Ooh, those are some fancy legal terms. Let's break those down in a way that makes sense for everyone listening.
For sure. So imagine a covenant is like a promise you make within a contract. Say you promise to deliver some goods by a certain date and you don't deliver them.
You're in breach of contract.
Exactly. You could be sued for damages,
Boy.
but the contract itself is still valid.
Gotcha.
Now, a condition precedent is different. It's more like a gate you have to go through before you can even start doing what the contract says.
Okay, I'm following you.
If you don't meet that condition, then some things in the contract might not happen at all, or the whole agreement could be off.
So it's a much bigger deal than a covenant.
Way bigger.
All right, I'm with you.
So in this case, Fantastic Fakes was basically saying, "Hey, Pickwick, You putting our name on that copyright notice that wasn't just a promise, that was like a basic rule for you to even be allowed to sell our recordings.
Right, like a condition precedent.
Right.
You didn't do it so the license is gone and now you're infringing?
That was their argument.
Makes sense.
But the Fifth Circuit didn't agree.
They didn't.
They said that the requirement about the copyright notice in Section 2 was just a covenant, just one promise among many that Pickwick made.
Oh, so not that big of a deal in their eyes.
Nope. They said that the agreement didn't say specifically that Pickwick's right to sell the recordings depended on them getting that notice exactly right.
So it all comes down to the wording of the agreement.
That's the big lesson here.
Yeah.
If you want something to be a condition, you got to spell it out.
Be explicit.
Exactly.
Okay, that clarifies things a bit, but hold on. Why wasn't Pickwick using their own name on the copyright notice considered copyright infringement right away? I mean, they were using fantastic fake stuff.
Well, it goes back to the fact that Pickwick did have permission. At the beginning, they had a license to distribute those recordings.
Right.
It's not like they were using the recordings without any permission at all.
I see.
The question was, were they following the rules of that permission?
Especially the rule about the copyright notice.
Right. Did their mess up with the notice automatically mean that original license was no longer valid?
Yeah. Did they lose their permission, basically?
Right. And to answer that, the court had to look at the copyright law in place at the time this all went down.
Which was?
The Copyright Act of 1909.
This is super important for any aspiring lawyers out there. The legal world changes. The rules about copyright notice back in 1909 are totally different from the rules we have today under the 1976 Copyright Act.
Huge difference.
Yeah. So what was the deal with copyright notices under that old 1909 Act?
Well, under the 1909 Act, the main goal of the copyright notice was to let everyone know that someone was claiming a copyright on a work.
Right. So it was about telling the world, hey, this is mine. I have legal rights to this.
Exactly. The court in Fantastic Fakes said that even though Pickwick's notice had the wrong name on it, it still did that basic job.
Oh, so it was a flawed notice, but it still told people, hey, a copyright exists here.
Exactly. They basically said that even a wrong notice is better than no notice at all.
Interesting. And I guess back then, the law didn't say that you absolutely had to have a perfect copyright notice to distribute something under a license.
Right. There wasn't this strict rule that any little error would void the license.
Got it. So that makes sense now, but something else is confusing me.
What's that?
We're talking copyright law, which is federal. But why did the Fifth Circuit use Georgia state law to decide if that notice requirement was a covenant or a condition precedent? Seems kind of strange to mix things up like that.
That's a really sharp observation, and it shows how different parts of the law work together.
Okay.
Federal courts often use state law to figure out contracts, even in cases that involve federal law, like copyright.
Uh-huh.
The general idea is that state contract law is the boss of how agreements are made and understood, unless it goes against federal law or there's some strong federal policy against it.
I see.
In this case, the court didn't think there was a conflict between how Georgia looks at contracts and what the 1909 Copyright Act said.
So they used Georgia law to figure out what that promise about the copyright notice really meant.
Exactly. State law for the agreement itself, federal law for the copyright issues.
Okay, clear now. But what about Pickwick saying they own the copyright in their notice? Wasn't that a big mistake?
It seems like it.
Did that hurt Fantastic Fake's actual copyright? Could they have lost it because of Pickwick's error?
That's a crucial point. Under the 1909 Act, small technical errors in the copyright notice usually didn't automatically mean the copyright holder lost their rights.
Especially if the notice still kind of showed that a copyright was being claimed.
Exactly. In this specific case, the court didn't find any proof that anyone was actually tricked by Pickwick's wrong notice.
They cared more about whether the notice, even with the mistake, still did its main job of letting people know about the copyright.
Right. And since it did, even with the error, Fantastic Fakes didn't lose their copyright.
So it's all about function over form in this case.
Pretty much so. The big takeaway is that while Pickwick messed up and didn't keep their promise about the copyright notice, their actions didn't actually count as copyright infringement.
Mm-hmm.
At least not under the 1909 Act and with their specific agreement.
It's a subtle but important distinction.
For sure. The court separated breaking a promise in a contract from using copyrighted stuff without any permission at all.
Right. Two different things.
For Fantastic Fakes, their best bet was probably to sue for breach of contract, where they could try to get money for any harm caused by Pickwick's mistake.
Rather than try and make it a copyright case.
Exactly.
Interesting. So what are the big takeaways for all the future lawyers listening to this? What can they learn from all this?
Great question. There are a few huge lessons here.
All right, let's hear them.
First, you absolutely have to use clear language when you're writing contracts, especially when you're talking about licenses for intellectual property.
Like crystal clear.
If there's something specific you need to happen for the license to be valid, you have to say that directly in the contract, no room for guessing.
Leave no room for doubt.
Exactly.
What else?
Second, it's super important to understand the difference between breaking a contract and copyright infringement.
Right, they're not the same thing.
Two different legal beasts with different rules and different outcomes.
So just because someone breaks a part of a licensing agreement doesn't mean they're automatically infringing on a copyright.
You got to look closely and see if they ever really had permission to use the copyrighted work in the first place.
Yeah, did they actually have a right to use it or not?
Right, and that goes to the heart of this case.
Okay, what else?
Third, you always have to think about which copyright law was in effect when everything happened.
Ah, the time machine aspect of law?
Exactly. In this case, the 1909 Act had different rules about notices than the 1976 Act, which got rid of the need for a formal copyright notice for protection.
Right. Big shift.
Knowing those differences is crucial if you want to understand older cases and how copyright law has changed over time.
Okay, that's a good one. Anything else?
One more thing. Don't forget that federal intellectual property law doesn't exist in a vacuum.
Meaning?
It bumps up against state contract law all the time.
Uh-huh.
Courts will usually use state law to figure out contracts, even if federal law like copyright is involved.
Unless those state laws clash with federal rules.
Precisely.
Okay, that's a lot to take in, but it's all super helpful for anyone dealing with copyright issues.
Definitely so. To sum up the big takeaways from Fantastic Fakes v. Pickwick International, be super careful with the words you use in contracts, especially when you're dealing with intellectual property, always separate. Breaking a contract from actual copyright infringement, and know which copyright law applies to the situation you're looking at.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
So here's a thought for all of you future legal eagles out there.
Hit us with it.
How do you think this case would have gone down if it happened under the 1976 Copyright Act with its different rules about notices?
That's a good one to think about.
Yeah, it really makes you think as you're going through contracts and licensing agreements in your future legal work.
Absolutely. And maybe spend some time looking into those notice rules in the 1909 and 1976 acts. It's really interesting stuff.
I agree.
Well, I think we covered a lot of ground today.
We did. Until our next deep dive, keep thinking critically and writing precisely.
And always read the fine print.
Couldn't agree more.
All right. Until next time.
See ya.